Hello, everybody. Hi. Welcome to the second session of the day. We have Ken and Christy here to do a presentation on building community food webs. Amy was not able to make it today due to the storm, so we'll be able to have Ken and Christy's brilliant expertise. Friendly reminder to silence your phones if you're able. If you need to take a call, you're welcome to step out. Ken will be doing a book signing at 6:30 today in the bookstore, so make sure to catch him for that. And the session will be recorded, so if there's any questions, I'll be coming around with this microphone so that you can ask your question, or the presenters will just repeat it as they're able. Thank you for joining us. Have a great session.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear okay? Okay, good. It's really great to be here. I've had a chance to come to this conference since 2007 talking about this work, and it's really taking a great trajectory for me to see how the conversation has changed, how the people in the room have changed, and what I've learned by having these conversations. So thank you for coming. And I'm going to be talking about, strangely enough, one of the most toughest challenges in a country that says we feed the world is for rural communities to feed themselves. And we're going to talk about that today. It's really strange that that's such a difficult question to raise in this country, and there's so much opposition to it. But one of the things that brings our different presentations together is that Christy's been doing some work in Polk County area, St. Croix Valley of Wisconsin. Amy from Land Stewardship Project LSP has been working on Western Minnesota since the 1970s to try to build local food awareness and build organic agriculture and regenerative farming and a whole bunch of other wonderful pursuits. But despite that, it's really been very difficult to get our neighbors in those places to really support this. So that's been one of the kind of themes of what we talk about today. I'm going to start. I'm Ken Meter from Crossroads Resource Center. I'm going to talk a little bit about my book and kind of the general themes that that book outlines, which is really summarizing about 40 years of my professional career trying to foster this activity of the communities all around the country. Then Christy will take over and talk about the organizing of the St. Croix Valley Food Alliance. And that again takes off of work that started back in 1969-70 as well. But you know, these things always ebb and flow. Part of the subtext here is that this is long-term, difficult work, and there's a lot of opposition. So we get to kind of think about how to manage that. Amy Bacigalupo from LSP could not get out because of the storm, so she's not here today. I will be showing some of her slides to talk about what we're doing. I'm working with them in Western Minnesota, so we'll talk about those. Our hope is that we talk fairly about 15 minutes each, then some time for you to ask us questions, to have a discussion with that. We may ask you to talk to each other about experiences you're having in your own region if you have time, but we'll see what brings here. I like to kind of show this slide of Kurt and Karina Bench. They come to this conference a lot, and this picture is now about 10 years old, so their kids have grown. But Kurt, when I met him, was working full-time for Archer's Daniel Midland so he could hire 21 people part-time to run his farm. And I think it's a real sign of where we all are in this work, that we sort of have one foot in this world of what pays our bills and what the society gives us. We have another foot in the world of what we're trying to create. And Kurt was able, after 4 or 5 years of doing that, to build up his CSA business enough that he quit his job at ADM so he could run his farm full-time. One of the things that really motivated his farming was he was trying to bring back his grandfather's sweet corn, which was the best sweet corn in the Toledo market. And what I loved about his story was that his colleagues at ADM said, "You're doing the right thing, you go for it." And I think that that's really the moment we're in, trying to make those relationships happen, to make those food webs happen, if you will. As I mentioned, I spoke as a keynote speaker here in 2007, and I've actually been going to organic meetings since 1974 and following this conversation in ways that I can, whatever ways I can. I direct a nonprofit consulting research group called Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis, which is very invisible because, intentionally so, we try to work with community groups to help them build their own capacity to do the work in their own places. Christy is the owner of Bees and Eaves Farm near Grantsburg, Wisconsin, and co-founder and chair of the St. Croix Valley Food Alliance, and also chair of the Polk County chapter of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Amy is the owner of Calero Orchard Organic Apples near Montevideo. She's a program and director for both Farm Beginnings and the Food Systems Projects of Land Stewardship Projects. So some great expertise here to work with. I want to start with a map of the places I've been privileged to work through the years. A lot of you folks have seen this already in prior conversations. This work sort of slowed down a lot in the pandemic because people got so focused on survival. But I've really learned a lot by visiting most of these places and working directly with people on the ground to kind of make more of this stuff happen and be more resilient over time. It's been a terrific education for me, and it's also helped seed a very much a national effort. This is a cover of my book. It's kind of the theme of today. Some people who are more academically inclined don't like the title of the book because Food Web has a very distinct ecological meaning, and I'm not using it in that way, but I'm talking about the fact we can weave relationships together at the community level, that individual strands may be very fragile, but as a collective, we really have a lot of strength and can really influence things in a bigger way. As was mentioned before, the book is available at the bookstore here. I will be signing books at 6:30. I'd love to have you come and even more have you read it and tell me what you think. So what is a food system? I think a lot of the conference material at this workshop, at this conference for years, has been very justifiably, very precisely focused on how do we produce the most crops? How do we rotate our crops? How do we build our soil? The very technical matters of farming. And often it's more difficult to step back and say, how do we actually build a food system that will support that? My soundbite right now is that we can't have regenerative farms unless our food systems are also regenerative. If they're not supporting farmers in a reliable way and built from the ground up the way that we tried to build our farms, it's very fragile, will very likely not last over time. But the food system starts at the farmers, goes to aggregators, processors, wholesalers, distributors, institutions who might buy food, restaurants, retailers, consumers, and ideally the waste we generate in that system goes back into creating new fertility for farms. But also that depends on the centerpiece of policymakers, researchers, technicians, health workers, infrastructure, and energy that all shape the choices we have. We also need clean air, clean water, healthy soil if we're going to make this work. So it's a very complex topic. A lot of people would call this the food chain, and I really dislike the image of chain for two reasons. One is, it resonates with slavery, but also suggests a linear relationship where one party can pull the chain and yank others into what they want done. I think it's much better as a cycle. But also, people have relationships across these units too. So any food system I know, whether it's a county or a valley or a region, has these network relationships. It's much more like a web than it is a chain. And if we think about it as a network, as a web, we have a much better chance of actually influencing it for the better. If we think of it as a chain, what limits our conversation right away. Some of the innovations of my book, I hope, is I think I'm the only person on the planet who's tried to document how much money has been taken out of rural America by the extractive economy. I started using that term back in the 70s, and no one wanted to talk about that. Last October of 2021, Secretary Vilsack used the phrase extractive economy. He uses it in a slightly different way than I do, but it's a real victory that we can even talk about that. And it's obvious to most of us who've been working in small towns and farms that that's true, that wealth has been taken away, but people have not wanted to talk about it, and no one has really wanted to measure what that means. I can document $4 trillion leaving rural America in the last 100 years. And that may sound like a small amount of money given all the huge deficits we're piling up nationally in the big national budgets, but all the farms in the US right now have a total value of $3 trillion. So that's more money than the value of all the farms that are really remaining. And of course, doesn't include the farms that lost their businesses because the economics were so bad. So it's a really huge, important slice of money for rural America. I'm not going to dwell on that today. I've spoken about this before. It was the theme of my keynote in 2007. Last time I spoke in 2019 said we've heard this before, so it's in the book. I can talk about it if you want to ask questions, but I have that pretty well documented in chapter one of the book. I got tired of writing the problem with industrial agriculture, the problem with corporate food. I got tired of just sort of writing about what is breaking down and what's interfering. And this gave me a chance to write about eight of the most promising, most systemic, most inspired community issues I've had a chance to work with. It's very limited by my experience and my particular take on who's hired me and where I've been able to travel, but there are some really great examples of people doing wonderful work over decades to make this different. The book also summarizes some of the key themes in my work. And it's written for a popular audience. I hope it would be a very good book for undergraduates to read, as well as local food leaders. So LSP is actually sponsoring three meetings in March where they're going to ask people to read chapters of the book and then talk about them together and see how that frames their vision for how they want to move forward with local food. And I've got a group in Toronto that's thinking about that too. So there's also ways it can be used strategically for folks to do planning with the board of directors or a local food initiative. The other thing I want to sort of focus on is that I've, throughout my career, I've had a pretty broad vision of the food system, what it should accomplish. Most of America talks about food systems in terms of who's making money, who are the most successful chefs, who are the most innovative farmers. That's very interesting, but it's also a very limited slice of the activity. I think we have to get back to where food systems actually build in our communities, whether that's a low-income community or a prosperous community, whether it's on the East Coast or West Coast, health, wealth, connection, and capacity. That's a much more difficult challenge than saying who's making money, but also unless we get to that point, we really cannot make things better. So I think it's important to kind of hold out for that complicated vision and try to figure out how do we think about that in a way that doesn't immobilize us. I just want to run quickly through the eight communities that are profiled in the book. Montana starts out with a discussion of an incredible statewide effort during the last farm credit crisis of 1980s. Conditions very similar to what we're experiencing today, much less public money available for subsidy, but farmers were sort of forced to go back to their own initiative and invent at the farm level, at the neighborhood level, to come up with new crops, new techniques, and new mobile slaughtering methods. And that was started by an energy organization because the farmers went to Aero, an alternate energy resource organization, and said, we're harnessing solar energy on a daily basis, you should help us. And Aero said, we don't know about agriculture, but we can raise money for you folks to come up with answers. It was a wonderful way of kind of embracing a lack of knowledge by giving small grants, $200 to $600, that fostered an entire statewide network involving 600 people. It's a really wonderful story of dealing with a crisis in a very rooted way and creating a statewide conversation. The story about Hawaii is very full of stories, ways in which, first of all, the plantation economy that did so much to destroy Hawaiian society itself is defunct. The last plantation closed on December 31st, I believe it was 2017 or 2018, when I was writing my report. After 120 years of operation, the plantation system created huge inequalities, burned up a lot of soil, redirected water in ways that were really irrational. And what people in Hawaii are doing is going back to traditional methods because traditional folks with hand tools fed the population of 800,000 people on the islands of Hawaii before the plantation system came in. Now the full-time population of Hawaii is about 1 million, and it's importing 90% of its food. So a really good experience about colonialism, the destruction of plantations, but also how traditional culture is a part of the answering that. Third, a food bank in Tucson that's really focusing on helping people who they're handing out food to become more empowered as citizens. So they're now having people on the board setting corporate policy for the food bank. One of the people that I mentioned in the book went through, was a food recipient who ended up running for office and becoming a park board member. Another person started a business using a family recipe to make tortillas that were more healthy for her children, and that became a full-time business for their family. So some really great examples of turning the food bank paradigm into a much more interesting, kind of more, much more potent approach. Then in Northeast Indiana, we go to economic developers in 11 counties in the northeastern part of the state who decided long before I got there that they needed immigrants if they were going to have a thriving future, because they needed new population, and the only way to do that was to have new people come in, and those were going to be immigrants, and they had to get the foods, culturally appropriate foods, that would attract people and make them want to live there. They brought me in and some others to help write a plan for what they call the Northeast Indiana Local Food Network, a very interesting effort to try to form a regional network to support local farmers supplying food for local people. In Athens, Ohio, a group of people about my age actually moved to Athens in the 70s, thinking that was a community that would be fertile for change. And they decided to start worker-owned cooperatives. They quickly learned that the people they wanted to join the cooperatives did not want to be in cooperatives. So they pivoted towards starting a whole different process where they really listened to their low-income neighbors to say, what do you need? What should we do that will help you out? And that turned into a food processing center where they can incubate new food businesses. They're one of the two centers in the country, in my experience, the other one in Montana, that are really doing the best job of processing local brands of food. So a really great story of people learning from poor people, pivoting their model, and then moving ahead with something that's really become nationally groundbreaking. In Phoenix, we talked about, we did a social network analysis to show how isolated farmers felt from the political discussion, from their customers. And by showing that isolation, I gave a speech in Arizona in early 2018, and city officials in 30 seconds looked at those social networks maps and understood they had to reach out to farmers in much more interesting ways. It was a very profound change, and again, a very conservative community where development interests rule, but we were able to penetrate that conversation to get more support to the farmers so they wouldn't feel so lonely what they do. Next is an even better story in Colorado, in a suburb of Denver, Brighton, Colorado, where the city and the county worked together to buy land at its development value, which was $60,000 an acre, $30,000 for the land and $30,000 for water rights. They bought that land and they are protecting it for permanent use in agriculture. And they're rebranding the entire community around agricultural heritage and trying to be a destination for food rather than simply a place where people put up strip malls and housing. It's a really incredible story of big conflict in the community and public officials let people spout off. They read words of the conflict and came up with some really brilliant answers. And finally, come back to Minnesota, to Dakota County, which has found a more collaborative discussion between developers and natural environment protection, where they basically set up a network of green space through the county, which increases the value of homes, but also makes sure that people will live close to green space because people want a place to hike and bike and so on. And it also creates a network of green areas for the wildlife can move freely from the Mississippi River or the Minnesota River through the county and still have some undeveloped areas to feed and live and so on. So it's a very interesting long-term view of getting people to collaborate to protect green space, not to fight development, but to integrate development into a concept that environmentalists developed. It's really a great story. So that's what you'll find there. This is the little inspiring picture here is Tucson, Arizona. This is an organic farm in the city of Tucson, Arizona, owned by the Food Bank, Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. And every time I look at that picture, I say, if they can grow organically there, I can do it here. I think I'll skip the rest of the slides and go on to Christy. Here you go.
All right, can you all hear me? Okay. I've got some notes so I don't get lost. All right, so as Ken and our intro person said, I'm Christy Lynn Allen. I am our chapter president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union in Polk and Burnett County, which for those of you not familiar with the state, I think if you go like this, we're on that corner on the border of Minnesota and Wisconsin, and the St. Croix River separates the two states. That's our border. I'm also the board chair of St. Croix Valley Food Alliance. Just to be clear, the Food Alliance is a project that was born out of our Wisconsin Farmers Union chapter. And so right now it exists underneath that umbrella. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background and how I have been inspired by my work with bees. It's funny that we're both talking about insects' home structures in order to organize, but there's a good reason for that. They're very intelligent. And then I'm going to talk about a little bit about the history of our area and how this idea kind of came to fruition when I entered that community. So I'm a beekeeper. I manage a business called The Bee's Knees. I celebrated 12 years of business this last year, and I grew it in Minneapolis, but I moved out to Western Wisconsin in 2017. I live on a farm with my partner, 30 acres. We have 4 goats, a flock of chickens, and then a lot of bees, and a honey house. So from very early on, I was fascinated by bees, but I started as wanting to be an organic vegetable farmer, specifically a CSA farmer. And I spent some time in Ecuador and Arkansas working on farms. And then in 2010, when I started my business, I also interned on a farm called Foxtail Farm, which they were established in 1989. And that farm pumped out over 100 different interns and 20 to 25 farmers that went on to successfully run their own organic vegetable CSAs. And I bring up this particular farm because it's, I keep bees on a lot of those people who worked on that farm, and they're a part of this organizing work. And we have a really incredible community of these farms, and they're really, really healthy places for bees. So the reason that I'm so inspired by bees as an organizing tool, do we have any beekeepers in the room? A smattering. All right, great. So the queen, everybody thinks the queen is in charge, right? That she is the one that rules the colony, making the decisions. Everything is her job, right? No. It's the workers, right? And when I learned about bees, my uncle is a beekeeper. I went to work for him after I worked at that the vegetable farm. And I was just totally hooked on the way they communicate and how the workers are all female, and they're the ones that make collective decisions. And I read a book called Honeybee Democracy by Dr. Tom Seeley, and he talks about the way that they, when they swarm, they actually, they communicate by dancing, and then they make the decision as a unit. And the queen, while she's really important, it's what makes the workers feel healthy and safe and that they can continue to go on doing their work. And one individual bee is not very strong, but a collection, they can do really incredible things like make honey. So in 2017, when I moved to Western Wisconsin, my partner and I, we found this really beautiful property. And then a year later, my neighbor came over and was like, there is a very large hog factory that wants to buy land 5 miles from your house. And when I say very large, I mean like 26,000 sows on 40 acres. The area where we live is all wetland for the most part, high water table. Our property's on the Trade River, which runs into the St. Croix River. And they were proposing to spread 9 million gallons of manure on 1,000 acres every year. So my dream property quickly turned into, oh my God, I'm going to be swimming in manure. But also knowing that this community and all the places where I keep bees and all these farms would be heavily impacted by an operation like that, because it's not just the one operation. They have to send the pigs to other operations, feeder operations, things like that. So our community got mobilized very, very quickly around this issue. And our Wisconsin Farmers Union chapter, when the former president that took over in 2016 was part of that chapter, there were 15 to 20 members. And then when this happened, our membership went up to 60. So we knew there was a lot of interest around organizing, and there was a narrative being sold about what the future of agriculture has to be. And we knew, because we were all connected in farming and growing incredible food in this community, that that future was not our future. But we have a lot of different people doing different, like farmers are independent, right? And they're off in their corners and they're doing their work. And when a threat like this, something so massive and seemingly impossible to prevent from happening, how do you get people to mobilize when they're already strapped and to do what they can, you know, to move towards a common goal? And again, as an organizer, as someone who took over leadership of the Wisconsin Farmers Union chapter, I was inspired by my bees to think about how we can collectively work together, make decisions together to move the needle. This is me with a bucket of bees. We had three rallies at our government center, and we had a lot of people show up, and we challenged them to bring a bucket of what they love about Polk and Burnett County. So some people brought like their hiking boots because they like to go hike by the river. Some people brought flowers because they love all the incredible like wild fields we have, a prairie and things like that. And we had, this was our crowd that day, and it was over 100 people showing up. And at this point, the situation was pretty unfriendly to us. We were labeled as kind of a bunch of extremists, activists. We hate farming. We're anti-farmer. And all of the people with the buckets run their own farms, and they came in the middle of the season to show these county board members how much they care about the area. We actually had our public comment. They wouldn't let us come inside and make public comment to our officials anymore. So we organized a postcard campaign where we had everybody write what they love about Polk County. And then I went in and I read every postcard with my 2 minutes. So, haha. But it was all about, we were really focused on water as our main issue, because our area, you know, there's a lot of farmers who are getting squeezed out and being forced into that bigger system of farming next to our smaller vegetables farms, trying to do things organically, trying to do things that protect water. And so, you know, it was a tough thing for our community, still is. I started organizing these monthly meetings called Chewing the Cud. And so we would just get together at a farm would host, or if we had to do it virtual, we'd do it on Zoom. And it really, there was no agenda except just to build community again and to talk to each other and to really find some solace in this issue and how can we make an impact. This was the first one. This is my farm. And this is a really cold Memorial Day weekend. And we had them every month. And they just kept growing and growing and became more regular. We still do this as a chapter. It's really pretty great. So out of these meetings was born the St. Croix Valley Food Alliance. And it was actually an idea that came before I was on as president of the chapter. It came from the former leadership who, they wanted to revive the chapter and knew that we needed to engage every member of our community in every sector to really expose them to what we have going on and what we should all protect, right? And because we are growers that are so close to the Twin Cities Metro, within 70 miles, most of us built our businesses selling to that marketplace. That doesn't really help you when you're trying to connect with your local community and show everyone what you have to offer if you're not even serving the people in that community. So the idea, the genesis behind it was, how do we get more markets for farmers in the area we're growing, and how do we connect people around food in a really substantial, meaningful way? But farmers are really strapped, right? They're already asked to do HR, hiring, business planning, marketing, you name it, right? As farmers, we're doing it all in order to direct market farm. So we came up with these goals, based on our mission to strengthen our local food economy, basically. And we've accomplished in 1 year all of the goals except for the market match, including EBT at local markets. That's something we're taking on this year. It's a lot more challenging and complicated than you think. You probably know. Some of you probably know about this. So we applied for a grant from Wisconsin Farmers Union. They have these quarterly local initiatives grants through, if you're a chapter member. And we applied to basically build kind of a brand around our collective of farmers. We had a history of co-ops in the area that, for numerous reasons, ended up not working. And so a lot of the farmers we work with are resistant to go down that road again. And because a lot of those farmers already have connections to customers and do direct marketing, we wanted to take that burden off those farmers and let's collectively market. Let's say this region is known for all the beautiful small farms that are doing rotational grazing and organic farming practices and beekeeping and such. So we made this video, and if we have time, we can watch it. We made a website. That's our beautiful river valley. We are still designing this, but we, in order to engage every sector of our community, we're like, well, why can't everyone be a member of this food alliance? And if you give them ways to become a member that makes sense with what they want out of the organization, join as a farmer, it's free. We're just looking for numbers, show you're proud of being part of this community. We feature your farm on the website. We do a lot of social media. We have about 30 farmer members right now. Join as a community member. That's basically trying to reach the eaters, but anyone that is really passionate around local food. And we're working on kind of a perks program so that people can go to markets and engage with members of the St. Croix Valley Food Alliance. Business owners, we're still working. We want a really intentional way for business owners to come into this. And because we're all volunteer and we're all farmers, it's taking a little longer. This is just a shot of us at the local farmers market, spreading the word. We threw a big launch event in August of last year, which was no small feat that we pulled this off because we were all farming and also had to put together this huge community meal. We had over 150 people show up. So we knew there was interest. We knew there was passion behind our idea. We sourced and purchased food from all the farmer members, and we served it to our community. I gave a presentation about honey tasting. We partnered with a local conservancy, Wild Rivers Conservancy, which their mission is to protect the national park of the St. Croix River Valley. And because our food, the way that we grow it, is in by nature, the way it's done, is it protects water. It was a really natural fit for us. And then the last thing we did last year was we threw a winter market, a farmer's market, and we partnered with a local landscape greenhouse, and it was a huge success. A lot of people came. The farmers did great, and we had a lot of interest from the Minnesota side, and we kept having to say, you know, where capacity is small based on we don't have anyone that we can pay to do this work. It's all been done for free. And one of my goals is to convince funders that what they really need to be giving money to is community organizers to be doing and helping facilitate this work. Farmers should not have to be spending their free time trying to figure out how to exist in these communities when there are super skilled people that can really facilitate that within the communities. This is just a shot of the winter market with the Christmas trees. It brought a ton of business to that greenhouse. They were pumped. They were like, wow, there's so many more people that would normally be here buying our Christmas trees and Christmas cactuses and whatnot. And just to play on the theme of a web, these are the different, it's a visual just of the different places we're trying to reach, with Wisconsin Farmers Union really being an incubation for us to get off the ground, and different groups that we've worked with. and goals we have eventually so we can have a voice as a unit of farmers within government, local and state, to say this is who we are, this is what we do, and this is why it needs to be protected. Thank you. Okay.
I want to hitchhike on Chrissy's comments really briefly to say that one of the things that's exciting about this is that it's been very easy to, for the communities, the kind of live-in community in that region, to kind of type farmers as hippies because they're selling food to city people and they never talk to each other. And they don't recognize as farmers who are neighbors who are feeding them. And I think this shift is going to be really important to having more support to fight CAFOs and everything else. So that's a huge difference. I'm going to do a bad job of what Amy can do much better, but this is what you got, I guess, today. I'm working with Amy and with University of Minnesota Extension and CURA to do a project in the Upper Minnesota River Valley. And I'm going the wrong way. Basically, the folks at LSP decided that they've been doing work for 40 years, and some of the people who'd been doing the work had aged out, retired, moved on, and they felt a need to really kind of reassess and say, where are we now? What do we need to do to kind of take this in the next several decades? So they formed a trio of methods. One is community asset mapping, one is listening sessions, and one is social network analysis. And it's a way of kind of being very rigorous about thinking about, well, who's out there? What do they want? What can we identify as the best way to go more forward? I helped them with one community asset mapping process. Very simple. The materials required involve butcher paper and a bunch of sticky notes. And we asked people for about 20, 30 minutes to say, what are the assets you count on for food in this region? And they put down the processing plants. They put down the co-op grocery stores. They put down the farmers they really especially like. The input dealers, and they developed a really great map of what was right about the community rather than what was wrong. It was a really good way to shift the conversation more towards what do we have rather than what do we lack. And very simple to do. The social network analysis is a little bit more painstaking process where we're doing interviews. They also did a survey of people to find out who are the people you feel most connected to in this region, to identify which people are the most central to getting word out to everybody else? Who do people rely on the most for advice or information or what have you? It's a very interesting process. It's what we did in Phoenix, Arizona, which works so well in communicating. Those network maps just in 30 seconds got through to people very quickly. The other thing that was kind of surprising about this process was that what was surprising about the process was that people really started calling the natural resources assets in the community. I hadn't envisioned that when I started talking about this, but they said, we have to value the geese that fly through. We have to value the clean air we have. And so this whole social network analysis came to include nature and talking about how do we relate to nature as a region. It was a very interesting shift in the conversation. This just shows some of the results of the survey. I think we actually have an old PowerPoint here, but here's a map showing kind of the bigger dots, the darker dots are places where people who have hold of information that's the most connected with everybody else in the region. We kept this anonymous because we promised people we wouldn't tell people who they're connected to, but this gives us a sense of like how connected is the region and how much is that centralized and how much is that really dispersed like a beehive. Here's a view of the whole network, everybody that we spoke with in the survey process. This work was done by a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. Out of those conversations came, what became really clear was that people were really thinking about a local grain milling process being really important. We're not sure if that means milling feed for animals or if it means milling flour for humans, but we're having that conversation right now. People talked a lot about needing a local food co-op and some other businesses, but we, out of that process, surfaced some recommendations that people in the region feel some ownership of because they're asked what they need, what they value, what they have as assets, and then what would be the next logical steps. I guess we want to show this. So The summary that Tara came up with was the maps resulting from, this is really hard to read, I'm sorry, but only 35% of the assets mentioned in this mapping process appear in the process. I think I'm going to skip this because I don't know this very well. But I think the maps will have to speak for themselves right now, just to say that by talking about network construction, by talking about building community food webs, we shifted the conversation from a commercial one to more to how do we connect as neighbors to build trust, to build relationships, and to move forward in a different way. And we have yet to learn how that's going to play out over time, but that's what we tried to do. I think that's all the slides we have for now. So does anybody have any comments, questions? If you don't ask questions, we're likely to show you a video. If we also might ask you to pair up and do some conversation with each other. Yes.
I have a really quick question. Could you go back a couple slides?
The question, and I'm going to repeat your question too. The question is, could I go back some slides? Which one?
So the organizing the food system resiliency, you had 3 points that I only got to.
This one, okay. So it's listening sessions, first of all, where people just, a room like this where people just, say, this is what's happened with food in my life, and this is maybe asking questions, where do you go to shop? What do you think the issues are? But it's a real open-ended way to not force an agenda on people, but at least say, what are you thinking of, and how can we find a new niche and a new way to move forward? That's the first start. The second step would be the asset mapping, where we convene people to sort of say, okay, here's what we got. And then the third part is a social network analysis. And that's much more painstaking. Is that okay? Yeah.
So the COVID-19 pandemic kind of fundamentally changed the way that our communities function.
Yeah.
At our college, at Northland College, like in areas where there's like high turnover of people coming in and out of community, I was just wondering if either you could speak on like how we can combat where there's been like a dismantling of tradition or like a dismantling or like loss of knowledge of like community connections. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Okay, The question started by talking about the pandemic and how that disrupted a lot of our thinking and kind of got us focusing on the emergency crisis and not so much on where we came from and tradition and the kind of stuff that's been happening. You're from Oberlin, I said, I think I heard? Okay. My experience is the pandemic really wiped out a lot of my professional work because people got so focused on, we've got a crisis, we got to get food out, and that was really good. And obviously very critical to do. It also really allowed some new technology to surface and allowed some new relationships to form. And now we have, Marble Seed now has funding for a local food purchasing assistance grant where they can really buy food from farms in the area and get that to lower income people in Wisconsin. It's a wonderful, that's a thought process that was very hard for people to have before the pandemic. So some new things became quite possible. I think the long-term thinking went away. And one of my questions is, how do we spend that money in a way that really promotes a long-term vision rather than simply saying, we got to get 200 boxes out the door tomorrow. And once we do that, we're not going to think about it anymore. And that's, I think, why these community conversations are so valuable. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd just say on an organizing level, let's get good at talking on the phone again. I love talking on the phone because I drive around from bee yard to bee yard and it's like a really good time to connect with people. And I think, I don't know about you all, but Zoom has a lot of limits, right? And Chewing the Cud was started during the pandemic and we were able to gather outside, granted in a very cold environment, which you come from as well. But people were also really thirsty for connection. And I would say really focus on the generational wealth. So seek out older generations because they've got a lot of really good wisdom and knowledge to share with us younger folks, but also create a situation where you can be exchanging and it's not kind of, one telling the other what the better way is, but more sharing those stories. And have fun. I think that's the other thing. you have to make it fun because the world is really crushing right now. And so it's actually revolutionary to have fun and enjoy yourself these days. Let's dance like bees. We had a Chewing the Cud where it was right out of the pandemic. It was in February, I think. It was really cold. And we had it in a barn, which is even colder. And we had Dancing the Cud. Like, I made a playlist. And it was, you know, all generations dancing together. And it felt amazing. So I don't know if that's helpful in that.
I just like to quickly add, too, that I worked with the Rosebud Tribe in South Dakota a couple of years ago. And they were trying to kind of show an economic case for the food work they were doing. And the result of that conversation was they basically decided the first step was to get young people to interview elders about traditional foods and old food practices and the heritage around food that the tribe had. And that led to getting a huge international grant for advancing their work. So I think that you know, I like oral histories as a way to get started. It's really how I got my career started. And I think it's also a good way to kind of talk about heritage instead of just the future stuff. You had your hand up first, yeah.
It's entering the courts now.
The question was, what happened to the hog operation? In case people didn't hear that.
Sorry. So. So the particular company is out of Iowa, but the end company is a Chinese company. So it's really upsetting for so many reasons, but also that it is really just coming in from somewhere else and trying to set up shop. So the towns mobilized and they formed a town partnership and they developed these ordinances because we can't, in the state of Wisconsin, we can't stop them from coming according to the law, and the DNR is the one that oversees these applications. They applied 5 times because they're trying to build on a wetland, like a literal wetland, which are supposed to be federally protected. But yeah, I don't know. It's crazy. The application is, they submitted another one recently. I hate to say this, but because of our proximity to the Twin Cities, there are a lot of, like lake homes and people who, have quite a bit of money. And one of them is a very well-known lawyer who he has pro bono taken on a lot of legal defense for the towns. And there's now a lawsuit in process from the Wisconsin Towns Association against these little tiny towns. And we're talking, you know, a board of 3 people that, like, they didn't even know what was coming. And Farm Bureau is getting involved. There's lots of really big power and money trying to fight these very little towns and trying to take local control away. So I'd like to say it's like a hopeful future, but the DNR, Wisconsin DNR, was gutted under the Walker administration and has very little power at this point. And so, yeah, we're still very nervous. And the alliance was, we wanted a positive thing for us to talk about instead of this, like, oh my God, this is so daunting. But it's still knocking on our door for sure.
So the Towns Association is fighting the little.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're trying to say it's like limiting businesses from expanding. These signs started popping up that said we support all size farms. The definition of a farm, right? It's a whole discussion that we've had many a time, and we're not looked at as real farmers because of our size, right? I mean, they have these ordinances. We'll have to see. It's probably going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. So vote this April for Wisconsin State Supreme Court. It's a huge deal. And the lawyer that's fighting it, he wants to bring it to the Supreme Court. They did a deposition of the guy who signed the application, and he lied under oath. There's like, it's really crazy.
I just want to add, too, the pigs will all go to China. This is happening all over the country where Chinese firm Smithfield, in this case, is planning these big CAFOs so they can export more pigs to China. And, you know, that's the other twist in this. It's certainly not about feeding anybody that you and I talk to.
Yep.
Okay, in the back with the maroon shirt.
In the last example or the last section, collected a lot of really interesting information about kind of what people's interests were in the assets around community food webs. Can you talk a little bit about like what the next steps are to like start to create that web?
I wish I knew. I mean, they've hired me to try to figure that out. And you know, the first step that I'm involved in right now is interviewing a bunch of people around the concept of, is there any kind of feasible strategy towards grain milling? You know, and you know, like we have farmers who are farming organically, who are rotating crops and are putting in edible crops that nobody buys. So can we find a way to make that rotation something that becomes milled into flour or milled into some product that people can use locally? There's also grain milling needs that also, you know, could be milling grain for animal feed. But you know, I think I'm mostly interested myself in trying to say, is there any potential for humans to eat food from local farms and try to build those systems? We're very much in the process of saying, okay, what have they already tried? What do the needs seem to be? What are the kind of perspectives of people working on this? What do they have? And I don't know what our next step is going to look like, but there's some complexity because doing the whole valley, we have the area around Appleton, Minnesota, we have the area around Montevideo, we have the area around Granite Falls, we were down in Marshall, and each of those communities has activity within the community, and they're not always networked across the region. So one of the questions is, do we just focus on one community where stuff is bubbling up, or do we want to focus on the whole region and try to make something that's more got a bigger consumer base and a little bit more visibility? And my initial take would be that what's really clearly happening the most vibrantly now is in Madison, Minnesota, not too far from Appleton and Montevideo. A woman has bought an old warehouse, turned that into a store she calls the Merck. And she's allowed a lot of people to start small businesses, a massage business, an exercise business. There's a concert meeting space. There's a coffee shop there. There's a little shrine to Robert and Carol Bly, who were poets who lived in that area. And she's got a lot of open space to work with and some investment money to kind of configure that building in the way the community wants. And there's a lot of conversation there about people milling grain in a small scale and baking bread together and sort of having very much fun activity baking bread in a new space that's commercially certified. But that may not happen. And it may not be the most strategic thing to do. So we'll see.
Hey, Ken, I want to make sure that she...
Of course, yeah. Yeah. I didn't forget about you, but I haven't done anybody in the back at all. So. Yeah.
I'm wondering, you mentioned briefly you did some work in North Dakota. I wanted to know if you could expand on any other work you've done with indigenous populations around food sovereignty, and really bringing in, like I said, that traditional, that indigenous wisdom that we can really learn from.
Yeah, as my map showed, I've actually worked with four tribes so far. I worked with White Earth a number of years ago to kind of help them do an economic assessment of how much food people were buying and where it came from. And, you know, I really worked with them. They did the survey process. But again, they went out and interviewed elders to learn more about how far they have to go to shop and how they feel about their food choices. And they also, out of that came a strengthening of the Manoman business, a strengthening of some of the craft business the White Earth has already put together. And, you know, the food sovereignty aspect of that is pretty ripe in that tribe, in that reservation. I also worked with Nez Perce, with an economic development officer there, to do an assessment of basically the local farm and food economy towards some recommendations. And I think on that one, they have moved forward without me, and I don't know what's happened in the last 4 or 5 years, but I think that helped elevate the discussion a slight bit, you know, among the tribal leadership. Then also worked with Rosebud, with Redco, and I think I've described that pretty well, but the data that we came up with both some financial data I provided and those interview findings really helped them get a big Rockefeller grant as part of an international competition. And again, they've kind of gone off without me, and I don't know what's happened the last 5 years, but you know. It's Redco. It's a, yeah. I'll think of the town, but anyway, I mean, anyway, there's a pretty good out of Redco is a pretty group of two or three people really taking a lead to try to stir up some really good conversation in Rosebud. The fourth tribe is Coeur d'Alene, where I worked with just again sort of a study of the local farm and food economy just to help sort of talk about sovereignty in the kind of economic context that America gives. So I love those projects. I'm now working with some folks in Alaska who are working in tribal in native villages, trying to grow food in Alaska with hoop houses, hydroponics, and all that, and greenhouses and containers that are hydroponic production. And that I think is a very robust conversation where there's been a 15-year discussion with elders about what do we need to do and how do you manage this process for yourselves. And they've decided our priority is to feed elders with healthy food. So that's the starting point of that conversation. But it's a wonderful, I just love the respect and the kind of thoughtfulness I see in that process. So it's my favorite story right now. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Part of what is happening here is kind of the end goal, right? So I was hoping you could speak to some of the outreach and opportunities that you use to get people in the community who aren't necessarily with it or know anything about the mission to actually be involved with things like this and maybe go off and join, not even as a farmer, but as a consumer and people just generally in the community.
I think that's a Christy question.
The challenging part of this is it's community to community, right? I think one thing that we've learned is how important it is to start with, you know, the people that you're most familiar with and see where it can lead from there, because this is all about building relationships, right? And so I like to I don't know if this ages me, but Mr. Rogers used to say, find the helpers, right? So I like to use that as my guide, like who's helping where and what are they doing, and then bring it in around food. And when I got a degree in global studies, and that degree taught me everything wrong with the world, but it gave me no tools or solutions, right? It was just like everything's messed up, these systems of power. But I'm a problem solver. I wanted solutions. And I bring that up because, you know, the real world is just, it's just very different, and the way people communicate and how specific in different areas. Wisconsin Farmers Union, some people want to form cooperatives, others are like, absolutely not, right? But it is a challenge. And we also have sort of lost the art of socializing through social media, through technology, but the pandemic really set us back a little ways. I don't know if that's helpful, but.
And I think what I'd add to that great answer is I think that the choir is really resistant to this idea, but I think the pandemic got a lot of people frightened. So I had a foundation in Indiana that hired me 10 years ago to study. Nothing happened. And then during the pandemic, they called them and said, okay, people now want to know how we're getting food from local farms. And that moment of education was very crystalline. I think the other thing would be, I had a conversation in the with Alaska folks last week about, they're getting money through an LFPA process to give food to low-income and elder people in these villages. And I said, well, you know, it's really great that they're getting free food for free, and food should be a gift in traditional culture, so that all makes sense. But maybe you could ask them at the end of the year to give you a $5 donation or a $20 donation, and then that goes into a fund for each village that they can use to invest in the next step, so that people who are now recipients become stock owners. I think another thing is to kind of, you know, in some communities where there's a meat processing discussion, then we can have local people invest in shares of stock to buy meat processing or help someone finance a new equipment. And that means they have more stake in that. So we look for ways to create ownership, to create connection, as Chrissy said, but also kind of, you know, just change the conversation away from like what's cheapest to how do we build this food system together. I'm also really I'm trying to talk with several institutions about you need to think beyond just reducing your costs and, you know, hiring the minimal staff, but really say that you have a role to help build a food system if you want to survive in this community. And those conversations are all very difficult to have, but I think you look for ways that people who don't get it now, a lot of people get it because they get cancer and they start having to be very careful about their diet for the first time. And that is how a lot of people get into this whole thing about eating better and wanting to know a farmer. But there's no magic answer. It's all dependent on the community we're talking about, too. Anyone back here? Yes.
We do engage people that are 20 and up, but we have a real hard time trying to figure out how to engage minors because there's always liability issues. Because a farm can be a dangerous place. So how do you work that into your projects using
how
you?
How are you working it in?
We haven't.
Okay.
They come, the children come with their parents, but there's a wealth of high school students
yeah.
in the area that, you know, we just don't know how to tap into that.
Yeah.
Have you done that with your projects?
There, we do have a school that they had like a environmental club. And we do have some farmers that, you know, will go talk to the school because they have kids at the school. As far as the high school age, yeah, that's something we'd love to do, but I think is definitely a challenge for those reasons that you mentioned. In your community, are there any programs around farming within the school structure itself?
No.
Yeah. Well, start one. It's a good question.
Yeah, there are certainly farms I work with that have just made a priority of making their farm safe for kids to visit and buying the insurance or finding, you know, you might be able to find a sponsor that would pay for insurance to create an educational opportunity for young children, or a school program is a great idea too. But there, for some farms, it's a very substantial part of their income to have that built up. So I think there might be ways to make that affordable. I don't know.
I was just going to piggyback on her statement regarding high school students. We have a special needs school that teaches horticulture skills and culinary skills, and they do bring their high school students out for farming, and we're one of the only produce farmers that they have as access. So you might look for schools that have programs like that, and also a lot of the high schools offer work study programs as well, and I'm not quite sure how the insurance works on that, but just a comment.
Yeah, we'll get both of you.
So I have a kind of a similar question, but kind of the other end of the spectrum. So I'm from northern Indiana, where, you know, corn and soybean operations kind of rule the land. So when we're having these conversations about building a strong food network, there's really no way that we can kind of cut out our conventional farmers. But it can be really difficult to engage them in these conversations, especially when the room is filled with small and organic farmers. There's often like a little bit of trepidation to meld those two groups of people. So do either of you guys have any experience in engaging more conventional farmers in some of these conversations and these networks?
What part of Indiana are you?
South Bend,
okay. I've done some work there too, so yeah. Do you wanna?
It is really hard. And I've actually found a lot more success in the beekeeping community because corn and soybeans are really bad for honeybees and most pollinators, at least in the way that they're grown conventionally. But if you can find, some So I know that Wisconsin Farmers Union does a lot of work around cover cropping. And so it's kind of like a stepping stone into, you know, bringing those two groups closer together, even though there's still a significant gap. I would say that in our area, what has connected us more is like water quality and the local control thing. Like, you know, so those are the my two thoughts on that.
I like those answers, and I would add a couple of things too. I think, first of all, I spent a lot of time trying to talk to conventional farmers who really are never gonna shift their thinking, but also there's some points where I think that conversation becomes more possible. One is they own farms, the older farms especially, that they cannot sell to their kids because it's too expensive. So the transition is an interesting moment because it creates a kind of scrambling. Also, some of their kids want to start a different farm. So that, you know, the staff person from the Indiana Farm Bureau, who I interviewed 10 years ago, told me on the record that he did not want his father's farm. He wanted a 91-acre farm that he could talk to the people he raised food for. And so, you know, he's helping young farmers configure farms in a very different way than previously, but that's also within a kind of conventional commodity conversation. So I think, you know, right now, commodity prices have been pretty strong since the pandemic, but people are also realizing that it's not going to work for them over the long haul, and it requires a lot of subsidy. So I think those conversations about, you know, how do we, I mean, we had an artisanal grain meeting in Minnesota 5 years ago, and three new farmers came to the room because I can't keep farming the way I'm farming. And we look for moments like that and embrace them with some support and resources. The other thing, you know, I also make a parallel with the Vietnam War, where a lot of the generals and admirals who were fighting the Vietnam War could not understand what they were doing was wrong until their daughters came home from college and said, what are you doing? And I think there's kind of that internal conversation some families have that allows people to shift and come up to a new way of thinking about it. So, you know, I think those are kind of the key points I experience. I promise this person next, we'll get back there, sorry.
Have you found that there's any common key factors in the communities that you've worked with that have been integral in terms of successfully like mobilizing these community food hubs? Have you kind of noticed any themes for ones where it seems like that momentum tends to build versus maybe some other ones that kind of struggle to mobilize and move forward?
That's a great question. I think, yes, I have found them. And I think also, for one thing, every region has its own unique answers. It depends on the assets you've got, the people you have, the leadership that arises, the conditions you're in. So every place has to kind of come up with this on their own. What I think the common elements for me are is that people take an asset-based view rather than a deficit view. I think you need a common core of say 3 to 5 people who are working together with a lot of trust, who have some fights and they fight fairly, but they come up with better, more agreement over time, and they decide to share information very transparently, and they come up with a vision that they can kind of nurture over decades. And that seems like a really common theme. The other thing is that they all are very strategic about limited resources. So they identify what lever will move the system into a better place. And they try that, and it may not work, but then they try something better. And they don't get too wrapped up in saying, oh, it didn't work, I'm going to stop. But they say, okay, if that didn't achieve the outcomes we wanted, what's next? I would say, and my book does talk a lot about the levers each of these communities identified that they thought would move the discussion forward. Clearly, a big lever right now is this BIPOC people surfacing, saying, we want to do this our own way. And that's often a very potent lever right now. It's taking a long-term view. It's being ready for rolling up your sleeves and having some failures, being willing to fail by trying some things that nobody else has tried. But it's also developing that trust that you like each other enough that you can reach out to people and bring a larger group into a common conversation. That's exactly what the process that Christy outlined herself. So you have more experience doing this than I do. So
I think it's hard. I'm not going to say it's been easy, and ask a lot of questions and identify people's strengths if you can. You know, like someone might volunteer to do something around this mission, but because they want to do it, but it might not be exactly what they're best suited to do. And that's finding good leaders in your community as well that have that skill to be able to facilitate that better.
Clearly, all those elements are involved in, you know, the CAFL issue became a lever for change and for engaging people, and you have a very good network of people who've been working in the woodwork for years.
We're pretty blessed with there are a lot of incredible people with a history of doing work, organizing work, and things like that. So again, seeking out those helpers, right? Yeah.
Do you have any experience to bring to this? I mean. How do you do that?
I was asking this because in our area that we're in Illinois, we're trying to really look at doing this type of thing, and it's really kind of its infancy. And so, you know, right now there's kind of conversations coming together with different people and whatnot, but. That's why I wanted to kind of see what seemed to be some of just the key elements and considerations and things that help, you know, move it forward to be a successful effort. So
what part of Illinois are you?
So I'm talking about like Will County area in Illinois. Yeah, yeah. It's like within the collar counties, but even our organization, it's multiple of the collar counties outside Metro Chicago. And some of the counties are a little bit further along in that, but specifically Will County is one that, you know, there's a number of small growers that are trying to, you know, do exactly like what she was saying about how can they kind of work together. You know, but then there are also as well a number of conventional farmers and things as well. So it's just trying to get all the key players, you know, to the table and start to figure those things out.
Well, one thing I did in another community in Illinois, which I don't think went anywhere, but it was in my crazy idea, was that there was a chef who was active. I wanted to lead some local food efforts. And I said, well, since you're a chef, why don't you convene a bunch of community meals, six or eight people at a table over 12 months, whatever, and just kind of curate a very careful conversation where you bring people who wouldn't normally talk to each other to the same table over food from a local farm. And just say, you know, let's talk about where this food came from. Let's talk about our vision for where we think the community should go. And I think some things like that are very soft really allow some of the non-choir people to get involved in a very non-threatening way, and also creates the possibility of people trusting each other in ways that they would never trust each other in a big meeting. So, I mean, I think things like that as a way of building your foundation. And then, you know, again, if you have a core of three people who can make that happen, then you might have eight people at the end of that process with a much more cohesive vision too.
I'll just add one thing on that. When we did the winter market at that greenhouse, it wasn't like our demographic of people that we would normally be interacting with. We definitely reached a different audience, and then that audience is going to have other connections outside of that, and they're going to be like, hey, this really cool thing happened. And it really, you know, the word of mouth and the relationship building there.
I just wanted to call everybody's attention to the little bags of blue corn chips that you get here every year. Look on the back of it, see where they're raised, right to the company. This, I'm referring back to your question about corn and soybean country. Joel and I were volunteers at Farm Aid a couple years ago when they were at Alpine Valley, Wisconsin. And one of the bus trips that we took was to a huge farm outside Janesville, Wisconsin. I don't remember how many acres, thousands of acres. They had the GPS tractors and the whole bit. But the son and the dad decided many years ago that they were going to try organic on 80 acres, and that was the birth of blue corn chips. And now they're raising, I think they went up from 80 to so many hundred acres now because the blue corn chips have caught on. And how many years have we had blue corn chips here at the convention? So it is possible. You find those farmers who have been raising crops conventionally, and for whatever reason, because of their kids' ideas, or maybe they just wanted to make money in a different way, they are there. You just need to start those conversations and get them going. But if any of you ever get a chance to go see the farmers, I can't remember their last name. It's a real easy German name around Janesville, Wisconsin, just between Janesville and Beloit. Try to go see them. It's very inspiring.
And Harold Wilkin, who's the Farmer of the Year this year at this conference, is going to be speaking soon. But he's also done a phenomenal job with milling grain on their farm and turning that into flour and then bread and shipping, mostly Chicago markets and more high-end markets, but a really big transition on their farm. So there's a story like that to learn at the conference, too. Yeah. Yes. Oh, good.
Sorry. I work for the Chicago Food Policy Action Council, and we've tried to do some social network analysis before, and we've run into a couple issues where it just takes so long. So people are really excited in the beginning, and then as the process goes on, people are less interested. And by the time we're done, the map doesn't necessarily seem to be as relevant as it was in the beginning because people's relationships change so much. So if you have any advice on how we could not necessarily streamline the process, but just make sure that in the end it's like really worth it and accurate.
I'm wrestling with that myself. I'm mostly say I'm confused and I'm trying to think about it. I think mostly you have to adapt the method at all steps of the process and sort of be aware of that. What I chose to do was really not strictly social network analysis, but was using network mapping tools to convey a story that would help galvanize a richer conversation. So we had a very limited, and it wasn't about having data on who's got the most connections or how robust the network is. That didn't interest us very much at all. So we did a very limited analysis. We came up with one set of five maps that were overlays that showed pretty graphically the isolation farmers felt. And so we had a story we could tell that was true at the moment we did the analysis that really pushed the work forward for now 3 or 4 years. And I look for discrete things like that are pretty targeted. And I think many people are trained in social network analysis, have been trained to think more about the data and a kind of the analysis and not so much about the outcome. So I'm really wary in this new one, I'm starting about it. Well, how do we do this in a way that really creates a richer conversation? But I think that's the thing. It's like, it's creating a new story and a new sense of possibilities. It's not about analyzing the network. And then you say it's going to change over time, but that's okay. We don't have to keep measuring it all the time because if we did that, we would get nothing else done. And also there are some real confidentiality issues, and even doing a good network analysis consumes quite a bit of resource, and it may not be the way you want to spend money in your initiative. But I have found that very profound in terms of the mapping. I think, you know, a lot of what we're looking for is a sort of galvanizing idea or, you know, what at this moment in time will crystallize people's thought they sort of have an awareness they didn't have before. And, you know, you don't know that until you talk to people, until you hear people and have these meetings. But once you kind of have a sense of, like, who needs to learn this, who has the ability to convey that, you look for those strategic moments where, again, your leadership group can say, if we take this step, we might get through to some people who are resisting us right now. And I think you look for those moments, and then it doesn't have to be a network map to do that, but it can be. Okay, yes.
So we have farm bread and dairy capable country around Northeast Wisconsin.
Okay.
And you were talking about that $4 trillion that's been extracted out of the farm economy, but are there any projects that have worked with the people that are actually doing the farm work? Or on these CAFOs, the landowners aren't the ones doing the work. It's at-risk communities, Hispanic immigrants, people that are on H-2A visas. They're the ones that are doing the work. They're the ones that know how to make it work. But the access to land, the access to be able to farm the way that they want maybe isn't there. Are there any projects that have success stories or a blueprint of how to engage with the people actually doing that farm work and let them do it the way they want to?
A terrific question. I'm working right now with ABBA, the land-based training for mostly Latino, mostly Mexican farmers in California, in the Salinas Valley. And I got to work with them on kind of evaluating 20 years of their program. And one of the things that came out of those interviews that was really profound for me was that, you know, people had come to this country, they got farm worker work because they could get the work, and it didn't pay very well, but over time they found a way to run a farm. And what we also found was that they were also having, you know, the farmers themselves were now saying, well, I want to feed my family, I want to feed my neighbors, I want to feed fellow Latinos, and that's not even what I'm doing right now, because I'm essentially raising strawberries for a bigger company that ships them far away. So that conversation's percolated for 15, 20 years, but it's there. And at some point, I hope we'll be able to kind of shift that into a much richer conversation. But in the meantime, we have 170 farmers, I believe, who have, you know, taken on ownership and are running farms for themselves and have the freedom to hire their own staff and to really make their own choices that they didn't have before. So that's a pretty huge victory. And most of them are making more money than they were making in their previous work. So all those things are good stories to tell. The group that's here, I'm not, Regenerative Alliance, here today, they're at the conference, but that's a great example of people putting together a whole vertically integrated poultry system for around 200-mile area in Midwest. I think you're outside of their target zone, but a good group to talk to and see what you think about their model, too. Mr. Greeno.
All right, just for Christy, an organizing tool in your campaign against the Smithfields facility, but I and my daughter flew to Raleigh, North Carolina for the Farm Aid concert last September, but we went to the film screening, The Smell of Money, which is a documentary film about Smithfield operations in North Carolina, and I think three out of the four people that were kind of featured in the documentary had won millions in settlements against Smithfield. Smithfields had never paid a cent of any of those. And I think by the time the documentary was done, three of the four host people had passed just from health conditions caused by 30 plus years of aerosolized hog manure in absolutely everything in their homes. If that isn't enough to sway people's opinion about whether you want Smithfields in your backyard, I'm not sure what's going to do it, but just find that documentary, The Smell of Money, and tells a lot about the history of Smithfields. You know, the largest hog owner, grower, processor in the United States. Again, like they said, wholly owned out of China, so
yeah.
Not really looking out for our best interest.
We don't have a problem with public opinion, actually. It's really a small group of folks that have been convinced that this is the only way they're going to survive as a dairy farm, actually. So they targeted the dairy farms that are getting squeezed out in Wisconsin. And, you know, it's 26,000 hogs versus 2,000 cattle is a very different situation, but they managed to galvanize those people around it. We did show Right to Harm, which is a very similar documentary. And it is just astounding. North Carolina, Iowa, they target areas where low income, they can take advantage of people who might not have the education or the resources to fight it.
What surprised the filmmakers was the second they showed up at these featured people's homes, immediately local law enforcement rolled up and was protecting the hog facilities. There's drones in the air.
Yeah.
I mean, complete government protection.
Yeah.
And even though it's, you know, killing their, you know, the citizens of their community and the pollution, and, you know, there was pictures from the, you know, the floods that were caused by the tropical storms from the hurricane that went through. I mean, millions of dead hogs floating everywhere. Those pictures were covered up and concealed, you know, from the public, you know.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. Yeah, and it is like a cancer that's spreading in our country. Like, it's so interesting, you know, you'd see a no hog CAFO sign and you'd see a Trump sign on the same post, right? So it was the only bipartisan issue in our area. And a lot of that had to do with it's China, which is also has its own problems, but there are ways that you can connect with people in the area. Those fundamental issues of of local control, really. Yeah.
And so far, police are not coming up if you start feeding your neighbors.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's still some hope for that. Any more comments or questions? We have about 5 minutes left, but go ahead.
I think this whole idea of, like, you know, having sort of these local conversations and things is wonderful because you can adapt it to that area. But when something like this is going on basically nationwide, where they're taking advantage of, like, small rural communities that have fragile ecosystems, is there any way that, or is it already happening? Are people sort of networking? Because you have a lawyer that's doing some pro bono work, right? Like, the issue is always that it's really hard to fight some of these things because of the resources that these big, you know, companies do have. And I'm just wondering if people are starting to network, because I bet a lot of the same work is being done in different communities across the United States.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of work going on. And I mean, it's why I joined Farmers Union, was because this was happening in so many different counties. And so they were, you know, that ability to network and then have shared. I think Crawford County is another example, not quite as large, but pretty big, and it passed and it went through, and so they're still dealing with that. But the only, like, federal legislation I've seen was proposed by Cory Booker, who was looking at it from a, you know, marginalized communities are really the ones that are taking the brunt of this first. And so I would love to see a larger effort. But it really is about what we're going to hear about from the keynote, right? This is the way, the consolidation and the power and the money and the lobbying that go on, and then we're left to deal with the aftermath of that. So, yeah, not to like put it down or on, but it's huge. Yeah.
Someone else had a hand over here. Yeah.
I actually just sort of a more basic question. You had mentioned that that a lot of farmers are not interested in being parts of co-ops, but will join a collective. And I know that there's, like, legal designations that are different. And I guess as far as, like, how that works out and how that plays out, what is the difference then between, like, working cooperatively in a co-op and working as a collective or working as a collaborative? Like, what are the differences between those structures?
Yeah, I encourage you to go to the, I think there's like a 4 or 5 o'clock discussion on cooperatives. But our particular area, the same group of people that we're trying to heal from a cooperative that went very horribly. And it had a lot to do with the people who were leading that effort had a lot of money and a lot of really good intentions. And then they weren't listening to the farmers. And so the farmers have been, and it created problems between the farmers too. So I came into the community, I was keeping bees in the area before I moved here, and I was kind of always privy to the conversations about that. And then by the time I had moved to the area, that co-op had disbanded. And then this CAFO thing happened, and it's like, hey, we need to get back together and figure out a way for us to show our strength and our power and also feed our community. So we're working back towards it. And Ken has said this is an endurance, right? This takes time, and it's complicated and hard, but it's so worth it. And legally, we're not the alliance. It's not like a legal entity. We're just, it's a project out of the chapter. We're thinking about what that looks like moving forward. But yeah, unfortunately, the co-op ship sailed and may or may not come back to shore. I don't know.
Final question. I think we have to stop so you can all get to lunch, but we can take one more question, and we'll just, there's this woman here right in front of you. You had your hand up too.
Oh. Thank you. I just had a question about land access and kind of piggybacking on the CAFO thing. I've noticed that a lot of small farms are getting all of their land cut off of them and just turning into, like, home sites. Mm. And then that land isn't even, like, most of it goes to sale at auction. I'm wondering if you guys run into that at all, trying to like get people to grow food without land is kind of
That's a nice small question.
Right, I know, that's why I kind of forgot about it.
The land access panel was earlier this morning, so we've missed that discussion already. But I mean, there are some, I mean, it's a real risk. We have so many people who are kind of aging out of farming, and there's no one who wants to take over the farm, and that's a huge gap. Also, some of them are here today who've come up with very creative ways of protecting their farm for the long haul, with a family trust or with a, you know, the Agrarian Trust has done some wonderful work around the country to help create 99-year permanent leases for people to farm together. And there's some people looking for new ways beyond that, but it's a huge issue, way more than we're going to have resources to handle. The Iroquois Real Estate Trust is here. There's all kinds of groups trying to figure out how to get the right resources at the right time. But I don't have any magic answer there.
Yeah, one thing I've learned just from, I had, you know, do you live in a small town?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you been to any of your town meetings?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that was really enlightening for me, and our county and town both went through comprehensive planning processes, and in that process you can influence kind of what the future goals of that area they want to be, and our tiny town of I think 300 people were very adamant they don't want development, they want to maintain the rural character. And there was some stuff in there promoting small-scale agriculture. And so if you can have any voice in that conversation or get on a committee to author some of that stuff, it's not, you know, it's a start. It's not like...
Yeah, well, I was kind of wondering if there was any legislative action happening with that, like putting into law, like, you know, Minnesotans first right purchase.
There are some brilliant people here that know more about that. But yes.
I can try to connect you when we get around. But the other thing I'd say is like, just to finish with my book, I mean, Brighton, Colorado, the city and county bought land, so it's in public ownership, protected for agriculture permanently. And, you know, that created a condition where other landowners put land in conservation easements permanently. So, you know, that's a wonderful example, which it's in the realm of a local government to do if they can find the money. So you still have to figure out the farmers. But
thank you, Ken. Thank you, Christy. We're going to wrap up here. Have a great day.